Welcome to Discoville, where we discuss both Star Trek Discovery and the Orville here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we take an in-depth look at each of these shows and discover that both of them can coexist in today's fandom as they introduce us to fresh, new, and exciting stories, characters, galactic destinations, and so much more. I'm Norm, one of your subtle podcasters here on Discoville, but you know on the Fandom Podcast Network, we don't do these shows alone. And when he's not crushing communicators in his bare hands, he's my shuttle podcast co-pilot here on Discoville, Mr. Kevin, the Raider Nerd Reitzel. Kevin, what's happening, my brother?
I think I need to build up some calluses more because it really hurts when you try to crush one of those old school communicators. I don't know if you've tried it. It's a little easier with the next gen ones, even though they're gold.
I'll tell you what, my heart was broken twice when I saw those things get destroyed.
Well, don't you have one of those like old school TSO ones that like have the Bluetooth and everything like that? So
I do, but I'm waiting for an affordable version of the new one because I do love the communicators. And so, having much more success this week at Tactical than Lieutenant Reese did, is the co-founder of the Fandom Podcast Network and co-host on both Culture Clash and the End Zone, Mr. Kyle. Quote, "I have a better shot at Tilly than Reese does." Wagner, Kyle, how are you?
Hold on. As long as she has her hair down.
That's right.
Yes. Well, I'm feeling pretty good, but Norman, will you read me a story?
Which voice would you like me to use?
This voice?
Well, yeah, you know, we could get the sultry tones of Davis Grayson. They're pretty relaxing.
Oh, he is. All I have to do is drop my voice a little bit and throw a little country twang in my voice, and maybe I get a little bit closer to Davis Grayson, right? So we have a great show in store here, but before we enter the Officer's Lounge, Kev, would you mind opening up a hailing frequencies and let our listeners know how they can find us and get in touch with us online and across social media?
Yes, you can always find Discoville on the subspace channels. You can stream directly from the fpnet.podbean.com site. That's where you can find all of our other shows as well. And, of course, you can also find Discoville on the FPNet on the Podbean app. Of course, we are on the master feed of the Fandom Podcast Network, which you can find on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play for your Android users. On Twitter, we are at DiscovillePod. And you can also use this Instagram on Fandom Podcast Network. And on Facebook, please check out the Fandom Podcast Network there as well and give us a like. If you'd like to contact us directly, you can hail us through email at thefandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com, or you can email Discoville directly at discovillepodcast@gmail.com. I'm Kevin. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. Norman, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Starfighter1701 and on Instagram at SoCalSwordFighter.
Kyle, where can we find you on social media?
On Twitter, you can find me at AKyleW and on Instagram at AKyleFandom.
Awesome. Also, please visit our TeePublic store where you can help support the Fandom Podcast Network while wearing your favorite show logos with pride. Just go to TeePublic and search Fandom Podcast Network. And we do have a Discoville logo that you can put on your favorite colored shirt as well as a sweatshirt and many other items there. So support us and visit TeePublic and search Fandom Podcast Network. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes so that new fans can find us easier. We love 5-star reviews, of course, but we love feedback in general. And if you leave us a review, we will read it here on Discoville. Speaking of email, earlier, we have an email, Norm. Mm-hmm. We got a nice subspace delivery here, and I thought that I would read it.
Please do.
Comes from Rebecca Skipper on October 13th. She says, "Hi. First, thanks for giving Orville the attention it deserves. Although I like Star Trek Discovery, Orville might be my favorite out of the two. Episode 4 was a little disappointing. The kill or be killed mentality is flawed. Through the story was limited by its 40-plus minute runtime on network television. I can think of one counter-argument to the Krill belief system. If the Krill believe that they are the only superior life form in the universe, then one day another more advanced species will conquer their Krill because that species will believe it is superior. I love the scene with the kids. That could be a breakthrough. It is a shame that the Orville crew couldn't get the adults to see things through the kids' eyes. Why not find a different way to incapacitate the crew rather than just kill them outright? I like the fourth episode of Discovery better than the fourth episode of Orville, but both shows have their strengths and weaknesses. Thanks. Norm, what's your take on that?
You know, that was a very powerful episode, and I know that there were a lot of fans out there that were like, are there not alternative ways that they could have dealt with the Krill directly? But I think that the tact they used on the show was that, you know what, we're not going to give the audience kind of the next generation way out. We're not going to find that last...
The cookie cutter, let's be better than them type of thing, you know?
Right, that 30-second, we're going to kind of wrap up an entire 48 minutes worth of an episode in 30 seconds or less. That was kind of a trope that the next generation was... You know, it was heaped upon them, and rightfully so, that happened. I'm not saying that the storytelling was bad. It's just kind of that's how Next Generation kind of ended up with resolving their stories. Kyle, did you feel that way?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes the Orville kind of stand out different, even though it is a tribute to Star Trek in its spirit, and we've talked about this before, the Orville always feels like we're still dealing with people who are in our age right here and now. They're living in our society, but they're in this future society. And I think if you were to look at it that way, I think most everybody would be acting the same way. It's like, we've got to save our own lives. This is how we've got to do it. If it means making this sacrifice. And again, they made the effort to at least try to save the children.
Yeah.
I have I want to mention something here, and I know I've mentioned it before, but one of the things about the Orville that I find fascinating is that they don't have the restrictions of the Prime Directive. And I think that's a good thing because it allows Orville to have an edge. And the way that the crew did what they did against the Krill, that's the edge that we're not going to get from, you know, what we've seen from past Star Trek. You know, we're going to let the Planetary Union is a force to be reckoned with. And that if you're going to, you know, challenge them, you better be careful. And personally, I kind of like the way that this happened because, you know, knowing that the Krill were able to see that they were able to use those special devices to camouflage themselves among them and masquerade as them. That's a big threat to anyone.
I know, that's true. And it's great technology to use, you know, especially in the hands of the Planetary Union. Very good points from both you, Kev and Kyle. And thanks, Rebecca, for your email. That was lovely to have. So please continue to send in more. We just gave you all the information on how to contact us just a few minutes ago. So the title for this episode of Discoville is 6 degrees of Spockeration, because in...
I'm sorry, I gotta laugh. You dove deep for this one, man.
I did. You know, and the funny thing is that I don't try and seek the threads. The threads are just kind of there. They kind of rise to the surface. So 6 degrees of Spockeration, because in both episodes, the main characters of Saru and Isaac, respectively, and their storylines are heavily influenced, and they channel several of Spock's most significant moments of character growth as seen on Star Trek, the original series. So it's time to relax, unzip those uniform jackets, and go off duty as we head into the officer's lounge for our episode recaps. So here in the officer's lounge, your Discoville crew will debrief you on the most current episodes of both Star Trek Discovery and the Orville. This is a spoiler-heavy discussion, so if you have not seen either episode yet, please pause the show and watch these episodes, then come back and enjoy our discussion. And first up is Star Trek Discovery, Episode 8, Si Vis Pacem, Para Bellum, which is Latin for, if you want peace, prepare for war.
By the way, real quick, thank you for pronouncing that, because I had no idea.
Golf clap, golf clap.
I try and do a little bit. Oh, you guys are terrible. All right. So unable to protect and save the USS Gagarin from Klingon forces, the Discovery is overwhelmed by Klingons that appear to strike now without detection. Lieutenant Stamets continues to suffer from the stresses of the spore drive as the war rages on. Burnham, Tyler, and Saru are trying to establish a diplomatic relationship with the Parvo, beings from a planet that has a unique crystalline array that can possibly detect cloaked Klingon vessels. Saru, understating that this is a planet of infinite harmony, has found a peace and serenity in himself through interacting with these energy-based Parvo, an internal piece that he's willing to violently protect if necessary. Meanwhile, Laurel has confided in Admiral Cornwell and seeks asylum in the Federation. Trying to escape Cole's clutches, she was forced to make a show of force, possibly killing the Admiral and pledging her loyalty to Cole, or is she simply biding her time with the Admiral's life hanging in the balance? So that is where we are with Star Trek Discovery, and I'd like to open up this group discussion where we will profile a specific character, idea, event, or element that stood out in this episode. Kyle, what did you think of Sivus Pacem Parabellum and what stood out for you?
Well, I'll be honest with you guys. This is probably was my least favorite episode of Discovery that we've had so far. There was something about it that just felt off and a little out of kilter from everything else we've gotten from Discovery. But there were good moments in this. Real quickly, I'm a huge Doug Jones fan, and I have to say his performance as Saru this week was outstanding, and it's really the first time we've really dived into Saru heavily. But to me, as far as a standout moment, it's that opening battle scene. Mm-hmm. And I think that scene brings up an interesting concept for Starfleet and what's going on in Discovery, and I'm curious to see what you guys feel about this. Is it just me, or does it appear that Starfleet's almost becoming too reliant on the Discovery and its abilities at this point in the war? It's like, oh, well, we have the Discovery. It can just be anywhere and bail us out.
That's a good point, and maybe that's where they're going to have to take a step back and say, hey, look, they're overtaxing the Discovery. The crew is being overtaxed. Obviously, Stamets is being overtaxed, and we're going to talk about that later. Kevin, what in this episode was something that was very appealing to you?
I'm going to echo Kyle's sentiments a little bit, and I'll get into more of that later. But the thing that really did stand out for me was the character of Laurel, this female Klingon here that apparently wants to defect. At least we'd like to believe that. I liked all the scenes with her and Cornwell. I'm also a big fan of Cornwell as well, and so seeing them together and her trying to help Cornwell escape in exchange for protection from Cole, and of course leading to Laurel apparently killing Cornwell to try to save face with Cole. This is a character that is becoming one of my favorites. I love the way that she looks. I liked how she got the kind of like war paint thing put on, but wondering how long that's going to last. I hope that we do get to see more of her. I think she's a great character, and for me was the highlight of this episode. I'll get into a little bit more about my feelings about the episode later on.
Yeah, Mary Chivo has actually brought a really nice kind of complexity to Laurel, and Laurel herself is actually written really well, and she has this great chess-like mentality of, if I go here, then my opponent will go there, and if something happens, then, well, I'm going to have to sacrifice a character in order for me to be able to take two steps ahead. That might be the Admiral, might not be. We're not sure. For me, one of the reasons why I called this episode Spockeration is because the original series is my favorite series, and one of the things that I saw that was almost as clear as day was that this planet was very much like the episode of This Side of Paradise, where Spores, the infected Spock, who was kind of the Saru kind of analog from the original series, or Saru is for Discovery, and gave Spock a serenity and a peace and a happiness he's never known before. Sound familiar? Because that's exactly what happened to Saru. Saru being the apex predator's prey, I should say, he's never really known peace. He's always has this heightened sense of danger, and the planets and the inhabitants of the planet gave him a moment's peace and happiness, and he is very protective of that, even to the point where he would sacrifice his mission to save this planet. So I found that kind of interesting, but I didn't really find it very original for me, because that's such a huge, I guess, I wouldn't say a Spock trope, but a very huge character building moment in one of the most significant Spock episodes. So as we enter the Spore Drive roundup, here are some of the other story elements I'd like for you guys to tackle. Let's talk about Time Lord Stamets. because there was a moment when he came out of the spore drive. And remember, he is getting used very heavily in this war because it's either you jump in, you jump out, and Stamets is really the only person who's taking on this burden. And then after they jump out of the last Klingon battle where they lost the Gagarin, he comes out of his stupor and says something about like Captain Tilly. And we were like, oh, whoa, 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 what happened there? So do you guys have any theories about it, Kyle?
Well, I'm going to start off by, since we're talking, brought up Time Lord Stamets, it's obvious Stamets is going a little wibbly wobbly timey wimey on us.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the storyline, though, is the slow burn they're doing on this. This has been an underlying story since episode 3 of the season with Stamets. And I just love how each week they're just putting a little piece of it in. And I really wonder if next week, being the mid-season finale, we're not going to see a big effect of this at a crucial battle for Discovery.
Do you feel that he's returned to his, I guess, his original Stamets personality because we're dealing with fluctuating versions of Stamets in different versions of his own timeline? Kev, what do you think about that?
Possibly. Whatever it is, it's making him one of the most interesting characters on the show. it's hard to say. I don't know what the long game or the end game that they have for Stamets here, but for him to have those injection things in both his arms and him be the reason why they're going to be able to do this makes him probably the most valuable crew member right now, next to Michael Burnham, if you ask me. It's going to be interesting how Lorca deals with this, because let's say we see Stamets having some side effects that affect the mission. How's Lorca going to react to that? That's the big question there. Is he going to let Stamets do it till he dies, or is he going to try to figure out another way to be able to call Black Alert?
I'm surprised that they don't have a backup for Stamets. Like, say something happens to him, because they need someone to be able to obviously be successfully recombined with tardigrade DNA, but it doesn't necessarily always have to be him. So it's just, I think that sooner or later, the Discovery is going to show some serious cracking, you know, in its foundation. And that's going to be a very interesting episode. But speaking of cracking in the foundation, Laurel's, her loyalty to the Klingon cause, where she is right now, and her supposed defection. Do you think that her desire to defect and to bring Cornwell to her side is sincere, or do you think it's just playing a longer endgame strategy? I know, Kev, you really enjoy watching Mary Chivo as Laurel. What do you think is happening right now, and where do you think she's going with it?
Oh, I think it's genuine, because I think that she sees the writing on the wall of what's happening and where she stands in the pecking order. And I think that this is something that she's trying to do. If it is not sincere, it's brilliant. And maybe she is trying to play both people against each other to kind of see the best slot that she can, you know, slide into, for not only for her own safety, but her own legacy as well.
So do you think that because he hasn't been seen since his exile on the dead Shenzhou, where is Voke in all of this? Or do you think that she's trying to...
Oh, you mean Ash Tyler?
The theories are still out there.
That's where he is. Come on, we're all thinking it.
I know. A lot of people are. There are pluses and minuses to that side of the equation, but it'll be interesting to see when Voke actually does reappear, or if Laurel and her strategy is all about bringing him back. One of the things I also wanted to focus on, and because I'm an original series fan, and I know you guys know the original series as well, Parvo and what I'd like to call kind of the shades of Organia, because in the original series episode, Errand of Mercy, the Organians are energy beings, much like the Pavans are. They are on their planet where they can pretty much create a truce-like atmosphere, which they're trying to do at the end of this episode, and they're trying to force this crucible between the Federation and the Klingons in their jurisdiction, if you will. Is that something that you saw as clearly as I did, that this is a little too on the nose of what happened in the original series, or is it just coincidental? Kyle?
Oh, I think it's more on the nose than they'll ever care to admit, because I think they're in its own way of maybe trying to pay homage to that episode of the original series. However, this is again where you brought it up earlier, Norman. You know, we expect something new from Discovery. We expect cutting edge from Discovery. And I think one of the issues I had with all of this was, too, and I brought this up a little bit earlier, is I don't necessarily need to see Discovery going Pandora or Ferngully on us. And it felt very strongly with that, with this episode. Oh, well, they've got this balance and it's this all natural planet and everything like that. And it's just, there was a lot of tropes pulled from one episode. And then you add into the fact it hits so close to home from an episode in the original series. It's almost like the writers decided to kind of take this episode off because they're planning, of all the big things they're planning for the mid-season finale, which is supposed to be next week.
Right. Kevin, what did you think? Did you think that this was maybe they're leaning a little too heavily on the original series to keep that original series crowd engaged with the show?
Yeah, but I think it was a little too much on the nose. You know, in a way, it was kind of taking an easy way out and relying a little too much on the original series with this Tipper thing. And I'll touch on that a little bit more when we get into the Omega 13.
Mm-hmm. One of the nice quiet moments, and it was nice character building between these two, because we kind of like want to see what's going on and where this romance is happening. We had Burnham and Tyler sitting in a tree.
K-I-S. You mean Burnham and a Klingon sitting in a tree? Is that what you're talking about?
Burnham and Voke sitting in the tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. I know a lot of people out there are like, he's not Voke. He's not Vok. Whatever you want to name him. He might be. He might not be. We're going to see. So, but I thought it was kind of cool that he has this really kind of rural, rudimentary kind of way that he wants to get out of the service. And Burnham's like, well, that's nice, because after I'm done with this, I'm going back to my life sentence. So the outlooks on people post the Klingon War, something that you never really see talked about in Star Trek. You know, you always see these people always, you know what, I'm going to continue my service. I'm going to serve on this ship. I'm going to get transferred to another ship. He's like, nope, once this war is done, I'm out. I'm going to go fishing. Was that something that was interesting because it sounded normal, or is it because he's not really who he appears to be?
Oh, it's a little bit of both. You know, because there's some suspicion there, but we also like seeing a little romance. Let me be clear here. I think it's more interesting, not the fact that we don't know his true intentions or that he could be a double agent or he could be a Klingon. It's more of seeing someone like Michael Burnham, who seems to be mostly a Vulcan, kind of becoming more human, showing her human side here. Mm-hmm. That's what's fascinating about this romance, not about who she's kissing or falling for, but that the fact that she is doing her part and her side of it. And that's what's interesting, because she's opening up more to the human side of her, which I find interesting.
Again, kind of another shade of this side of paradise when they're on a planet and letting her Vulcan side down and embracing more of her passionate human side. I'm just saying.
Spockatron.
There's one thing about that kiss, too, and I don't know how you guys feel about this. I almost feel like we had the kiss in last episode, but that quick kiss almost felt earned because we knew they'd been through a time loop over and over and over again. And we kind of saw how Burnham was still trying to process all the ramifications of that. And to go from how she was at that end of that episode to just kissing him like she did in this episode, that kiss almost didn't feel earned in an aspect, if you can understand what I'm saying. It was like we got to that point awful quick from where we ended off in Burnham's emotional state at the end of the last episode.
Are you saying that it felt forced?
It felt a little forced, yeah.
Okay. Okay, I can see what you're saying, yeah.
Spores, baby, spores. That's what happens on Pandora. I mean, Parvo. I mean, spores. Well, as much as we enjoy talking about all these different points on Star Trek Discovery, let's find, hopefully, not a too arrogant artificial intelligence pilot. Have him shuttle us over to see what's happening on the Orville on episode 8, Into the Fold. As the Orville sits in space dock for upgrades to their navigational systems, Dr. Claire Finn is trying to wrangle her two sons so she can spend some family time with them on a nearby entertainment play planet. Needing Lieutenant Lamar's expertise with the nav systems on the Orville, Isaac was sent in his stead to be Claire's shuttle pod pilot, with the added benefit of being able to observe Claire's family dynamics with her sons. Getting more than he bargained for, and observing the boys constantly nipping at her heels and at each other, circumstances beyond their control force them to land on an uncharted moon thousands of light years away from the Orville. Separated from each other, Claire being held hostage by a local hermit, and Isaac and the boys trying to find her and salvage the shuttle, they all begin to realize how much they mean to each other, even if only hours ago they were all getting on each other's last nerve. And the Spockeration theme for this episode is heavily drawn from the Galileo 7. That's how I felt about it. And amongst other shuttle missions gone awry, as Isaac learns that logic and detachment is not the only way to survive a dire situation. So let's start the group discussion here with Kev. Kev, you love one of the special guest stars on this episode. Tell us a little bit more about our mountain hermit.
Yes, our mountain hermit played by Brian Thompson. Now, even though this wasn't my favorite role of his, I'm a huge fan of him. He was the one that that captured Claire and held her hostage. And we've seen him in Star Trek Next Generation as the second officer Clagg, Star Trek Generations as the Klingon helmsman, Deep Space Nine and two characters. And also, he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer's two characters. And, of course, he might more be recognized as the alien bounty hunter in X-Files.
Oh, yeah.
But in a couple of my guilty pleasures, I loved him as Eddie Fiore in Kindred the Embraced Vampire short-lived TV series. And, of course, the Night Slasher in Cobra with Sylvester Stallone.
That's where he got his start, right?
Yes, that was his big role. He played the leader of the killing slasher cult. And by the way, there was a lot of iron pipes used in that. Hashtag, you got to listen to Bloody Kings for that reference. But anyway, so I'm a huge fan of his. He's got this very angular face, which makes him really a good-looking bad guy. And I was really happy that they went to the Star Trek well of great Star Trek guest stars, just like they did with James Horan in a previous episode with Krill. It was great to see Brian Thompson back and him doing what he does best is playing creepy bad guys.
Well, I mean, continuing the theme of characters being part of what was special in this episode for us, Kyle, I think you and I are on the same page here when it comes to your pick.
Yeah, Isaac was the highlight of this episode, and I talked about this a little earlier, and I want to expand on it. I think Isaac, more than any other character since the Orville has started, has gotten the most development from beginning of the season till now. And what I find so interesting is, you know, people, you want to make the comparison to Data, but here's the thing. We've never seen Isaac necessarily trying to become more human. He's just trying to understand the species to report back to his own species. So you don't have, it's not quite that Data quest to trying to be more human and find his emotions, but in his own research, he's discovering things within himself. And I think it's such a great twist, and it's very interesting to see how it develops. And you see it right up until the very end of this episode when basically Claire tells him he's part of the family. And it's like, and he's bonded with her children, which big shock there, by the way.
Yeah, you know, this episode wasn't what I expected it to be based on the previous, because I was waiting for, I guess it would be a Claire, more Claire-centric episode, because in every episode that we've seen so far, you got to see kind of like a standout and breakout performance of a particular cast member. In Majority Rule, it was Lamar. In Krill, it was, who was the other guy? The Navigator.
Malloy,
thank you.
Malloy, yeah.
It was Malloy's role, you know, and then in one episode, it was, you know, Alara taking command. So I wanted it to be like Claire, kind of like at the A story and whoever else was going to be there at the B story. But I was really pleasantly surprised that it was a very balanced episode between what happened with Isaac and what was happening with Claire, because they kind of worked seamlessly and interwoven themselves together really nicely. So
Yeah,
I'm
was
sorry,
great.
Tim, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but I want to mention real quick. It was great because we hadn't seen episodes that really highlighted them well, and it was nice that there was the perfect balance between those two characters getting highlighted in this.
There's also kind of like a soft comparison to a relationship that was in The Next Generation between Dr. Pulaski, Diana Mulder, who played Dr. Pulaski, and kind of her, I guess, irritation with artificial life forms because she and Data never really got along. So there's that comparison that has been drawn out there in social media, but that's what social media does. They love drawing comparisons. So aside from our group picks, let's engage the Quantum Drive here for a quick roundtable discussion on some of the finer points seen in this episode. So let's talk about Isaac a little bit more, because I found him very engaging in this, unknowingly becoming a surrogate father, do you think? Because he had to basically bring along both Marcus and Ty along in his missions and make sure that they were safe. And I think that he learned a lot about the human condition, unlike Data, over the course of this episode. But not so much for him, but in the eyes of these two kids, he became kind of like that father figure that they didn't have. Claire admitted to this because she was artificially inseminated to become a mother, which Isaac kind of pointed out very brusquely. It's like, oh, you know. So, yeah, what did you think about that? Did you see Isaac becoming unwillingly the surrogate father figure?
I think that, you know, if you go from the beginning of the episode where he was going to volunteer to vaporize her kids, which I thought was funny to stop them from laughing, to the touching scene of holding hands with one of the kids and caring for them, definitely. And if you look at it, that's kind of his prime directive is to learn about humans and to better the relationship between, is it Kalon? Is that what he is?
The Kalons, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Kalons. And to learn more about the humans and their behavioral, you know, what they do and their status and such. So this is something that he has to learn. And I think he learned quite a bit on this mission. More than he bargained for.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things, too, to spin out of this, and something worth noting for future episodes of the Orville, especially now that we know we are getting season two, is there's a storyline here with Isaac where he might have to go back to the Kalons, and they might decide he's become too assimilated into human culture. And it's changed him too much to be a member of the superior species.
That is something that in science fiction that is kind of a traditional storytelling element for sure.
So I could definitely see that story coming along at some point. And again, it's the growth of this character. And Kevin talked about holding the one boy's hand when he does use Claire's voice to tell them a story to get them to sleep. I mean, just those little moments within this episode just really stood out for Isaac.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because that's something that I brought up here for the Quantum Thrive discussion is the bedtime story. I thought this was probably one of the most successful narrative elements to show how Isaac has changed over the course of the episode, because it started off with the children. Can you tell us a bedtime story? And Isaac's like, we crash landed. Your mom's missing. We're going to die. There are barbarians here. The water's poisoned. The end. Something to that effect. And the kids are like, I hate that story. Tell us something different. So he started talking about their favorite story, which was Peter Rabbit. And then they said, can you talk about it in mom's voice? And you saw these steps and you're like, wow, this is exactly the progression of this character in this very short scene. I thought that was really brilliant. One of my favorite scenes in the episode. Did you guys think so?
No, oh, I agree with that completely.
Oh, totally agreed. Yeah, totally.
So let's talk about Drogon again a little bit more, because that was Brian Thompson's character. And one of the things that I found interesting about bringing in an actor like a Star Trek alumni like him was that we never really got to see his particular motivations of why he wanted Claire aside from companionship, because there are so many things that were happening in this episode. You had Isaac's story, you had Claire's story, you had the search party story, and then you had Drogon's story and kind of the soft story of what's happening with the rest of the zombie-like inhabitants of the planet. So do you think that he was kind of cut short in terms of seeing enough of him? Because aside from being any type of throwaway character, we never really got a chance to feel kind of that the Brian Thompson flavor, you know, that threatening presence that he has. What did you think about that, Kev? Because I know you like seeing him.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I felt that I wish there was a little bit more about what he wanted in the long term. But what we end up getting more was how menacing he is because of how tall he is. And it was kind of echoing Misery and 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it a little bit, mm-hmm. That's kind of what we were getting at, out of this. I would have liked to have kind of seen him get a little more personal with her and try to let her know so she could maybe sympathize with his character and his situation a little bit more, as opposed to being this kind of hulking guy that is just keeping her captive and trying to scare her. Maybe show a little more compassion towards trying to help her find her kids, because I think humanizing him a little bit more in the story would have been a lot more fascinating, which is why, as much as I like Brian Thompson, this isn't one of my favorite roles, but I was happy to see him in this role.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that has been interesting about the way that the last few episodes of The Orville, and in terms of their writing and their balancing, trying to strike that balance between kind of like drama and action and humor, there wasn't really a lot of humor. Not that, you know, that crass kind of traditional Seth MacFarlane humor. I think that for some reason, and you guys may disagree or agree, and the listeners, I'd love to know what you think about this. I think that he sold the premise of The Orville with Family Guy meets Star Trek. I think that's how he pitched it to Fox. I think that he's like, you know what? I'm going to play to my strengths. I'm going to give you something that you guys can deliver a really good advertising base for. But I think over time, you've really seen a lot of that humor kind of taper off. You've seen moments of humor like this point I wanted to make here with the glory hole, because it's a hilarious joke, but it's not overdone anymore. That humor isn't really at the center of why people have to critique this particular element of the show. I think the show has hit such a good balance of where it needs to be, because they don't really pursue a joke like this as long as they used to in earlier episodes. Kyle, what did you think about that joke? Do you think that, yes, they did it there to break the tension, but they don't really chase the joke anymore?
No, I agree with that. And I think this is actually something that's showing the growth of Seth MacFarlane as a creator. Yeah, he can still do that crass humor, but I'm glad you brought this up, because over the weekend, Once Upon Our A Million Ways to Die in the West was on. And I sat down, and I haven't watched that in a while, so I sat down and watched it. And, I mean, it was just crash joke after crash joke after crash joke. And you see it here, and I think it's a combination of Seth MacFarlane growing as a creator, but also because Seth MacFarlane has such a reverence for this genre and trying to pay tribute to Star Trek, it's enabled him to keep a balance. And I think we as the viewer are the ones benefiting from it. And I think you hit it on the head. I think that Seth MacFarlane kind of pulled a fast one on Fox, promising a little more comedy than what we've been giving. But I think Fox is very happy with the product as well. And it's something that happens in Hollywood a lot, where the writers will kind of tell a little fib to get their show pushed through. And then it's like, once it's made, it's like, well, wait, this wasn't what we were promised. But hey, look, it's doing well. So I think that's MacFarlane pulled a little trick, and I think MacFarlane is, and we keep going back to this, but MacFarlane has some power over Fox that very few other people have.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I think also that they are trying to tap that. And we're giving Seth MacFarlane a lot of credit here, but I think we need to give a little more credit to people like Brandon Braga, as well as the other writers and producers of the show.
Yeah, I think when I say that, I'm trying to say the powers that be that run the show in general.
Well, I think they're also keeping him in check, and I think he's feeding off that really well. I think they have a good team here writing the show, and as you know, as we all saw that first trailer for this TV show, it definitely had a lot more comedy to it, and that really brought the audience in. And I think that was the master plan. When I look back at now, thinking that okay, we're gonna draw them in with a comedy Star Trek, because this is something that is kind of new. If you don't count Galaxy Quest. But Galaxy Quest hit a certain tone with everyone that I think that people were expecting from this. Yet they were planning in the long run to have some good writing, good drama, good character development, and then kind of still throw in the humor to still kind of, bring it apart from your normal Star Trek. So I do want to give credit to the rest of that team of the producers and the writers, because I think that with Seth MacFarlane in the front seat there, I think he's in a way being held in check, but also respecting what other people are saying and taking their suggestions as well.
No, I totally agree. Very good points, and thank you for bringing Brannon and respecting like the quality of the writing staff there. So great conversation on the Orville as always. In this week's roundup, I think that for me, it's still proving to escalate and climb and evolve and bring us a lot of really great entertainment. And now it is time to
activate the Omega 13.
So because we're huge Galaxy Quest fans, we love the idea of the Omega 13 device. When activated, the Omega 13 allows a short span of time to be rewritten or to relive something or even possibly correct a mistake. So on either Star Trek Discovery or the Orville, you can only choose one because that's the rule of the Omega 13. Was there a particular scene or event this week that made you either rewatch it or want to rewrite it? Kyle, let's start with you.
Well, and I'm going to go back to something I brought up before in this episode. I didn't need Discovery Pandora. I think there were a lot of other ways they could have gone with this than having this forest nature aspect of it going on that becomes this trope to bring Discovery and the Klingons together. I think there were a little more originality from Discovery would have been good this week, I think, is my feeling with that.
And Kevin, how about you?
We get 13 seconds, right, to rewatch or redo something. Is that it?
Well, yeah, it's the 13-second point where, yeah.
Okay, so then mine would be putting a memo in the writer's room and saying, don't mail this one in. Don't do too much on the nose from the original series. And like Kyle said, we didn't need the trope of this whole Avatar thing. But the thing that bugged me, though, because this is my least favorite of the series so far, is I started thinking about the Next Generation episode Power Play, mm-hmm. where the way team went down and there was storms and they were trying to beam them back, and these energy beams went in and took over their bodies of I think it was O'Brien and Ro and Data, and they were influenced by this alien species on this planet. And we've seen this plenty of times in other Star Trek episodes too. And seeing Saru, to me, I didn't feel it was Saru's character being the one that was influenced by that, because he happened to be the one in charge. I think it would have been more interesting if maybe it happened to either Ash or Burnham, but because there was the command structure and it was the commander that got influenced, I was just like, oh man, come on, and I kind of got the Avatar vibe as well, but it would be rewriting that episode, or at least telling the writer room to do something different here, surprise us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So both of you guys are on the side of rewrite on Discovery. For me, my pick, and it has been pretty much so far every episode of Discoville, it's a moment on the Orville where it literally stopped me dead in my tracks, because it was pretty much a perfect moment for me. When Claire was treating her child, her youngest child, Ty, and he was dying because of that mutation, that toxin in the water. She says that, I can't just sit here and watch him die. And then all of a sudden, there's this really quiet moment, and the music was fantastic in the scene, where Isaac reaches out and holds her hand. That is what proves to me that they know how to write these characters, because the very first time he did it was when Marcus, like, just hold Ty's hand, just do it, because that's what a normal human being would do. Show some compassion. But without provocation or prompting, he did the exact same thing, because that was at the moment where Claire needed somebody to be compassionate. And it ended up being a robot who learned. That was the whole point of the episode, done perfectly in those 13 seconds. So it was brilliant between those two. And that was my pick for the Omega 13. So lastly on the show, one of the things that I wanted to get into with subspace signals, as we activate the subspace signals. This topic is something that I don't even know if we have enough time for in one episode, let alone several. The continual which is better debate. Why do fans always adopt the mentality one has to be better than the other? Why does that matter so much in social media debates, especially where these two shows are concerned? I saw an article I think you shared with us, Kevin, on Discoville. Mm-hmm. And it basically was like, hey, you know what? This is why The Orville is better than Star Trek Discovery, because first of all, ratings points, and second of all, because reasons. So let's start with you, since you posted the article. Why do you think this is so important to people out there?
Well, first of all, you're dealing with very opinionated Star Trek fans. And I'm going to be honest. Star Trek fans are some of the most opinionated out there. And I'm not afraid to say that, because I'm a Star Trek fan and I see it all the time. And in some cases, some of the most negative and quick to judge. I'll be honest, I'm calling you guys out. And this is one of those things where we've seen a lot of backlash about that Star Trek Discovery is not Star Trek. You know, it's not what Gene Roddenberry would have wanted. The show is taking a chance and it does have a vision, and I like the show a lot. When it comes to Orville, it's settling more with Star Trek fans more, I think, because it's feeling more like, especially Next Generation fans and Deep Space Nine fans. But it's one of those things where everyone loves lists. You know, everyone loves to say what's the best, what's second best, what's the worst. And it's just one of those things that creates conversation, whether it be negative or positive. Some people like to handle it more of a negative vibe, and it comes from review sites as well, like Rotten Tomatoes. You know, it's either a yes or a no. There's no middle ground. There's no someone saying, you know what, I didn't care for this film, but you know what, if you like this, this, and this, you will love this film. And people don't like to say that, you know. And that's what I like about this show of Discoville, is that even though Kyle and I found faults in this week's episode of Star Trek Discovery, there's things that we still liked about it, you know, and that we talked about it. And, you know, we're not trying to say that one is better than the other. You should watch only one over the other one.
And that's what I'm trying to get to. It's like we're I think, probably on the other side, the smaller percentage of fans out there that can say, you know what, these two shows are both enjoyable in their own rights. But Kyle, you and I have had many discussions about this. And why is it? It has to be one or the other. That's what I still don't get. And maybe it's because I'm a little older. Maybe I'm a little wiser. I don't know. But I don't understand why it has to be a zero-sum game. Someone has to win and someone has to lose this argument. Why do you think that is the way it is, at least in terms of these two shows? Because, you know, when it comes to, say, like Star Wars, there's, oh, you can only watch the original trilogy. If you're not an original trilogist, then you're invalid, or it's either TOS or TO, you know. But these two shows seem to be so divisive in the fandom community. The chasm between the two is just remarkable.
Well, I got to go back and say, you can only upvote one of these shows. And if you upvote one, you have to downvote the other, you know, just steal a little bit from the Orville from last week. But no, I think it's the thing in society anymore is, and I know we've talked about this, Norman, is there's no room anymore for intelligent debate. It's I'm right, you're wrong, and you either have to like what I like or you're wrong. And I think what we're seeing, especially in social media, because everybody has the same soapbox to stand on, instead of people stopping to listen to the other side of the debate, it's just everybody's yakking at each other. And it's just all become noise. And especially when you're in fandom, where I love fandom. I've been a part of fandoms for as long as I can remember. And it's one of the best things about fandom is how passionate people get. But as part of that passion, sometimes we let the passion take over and we don't stop to listen. And there's no reason why you can't like both of these shows. And I think with Discovery And it's reason why a lot of people are having a problem with it, especially a lot of more diehard Star Trek fans, is Discovery is the first show that's truly showing kind of the underbelly of Star Trek. It's kind of the dark side of Star Trek. It's hitting a period in the development of Starfleet and the development of the human race in Star Trek that was not a banner time for how human beings acted and things we did. And people are so locked into the idea of the Roddenberry Star Trek, where everything is this perfect, almost perfect thing. Humans are, they're flawed, but they're infallible too. It's, you know, everything gets wrapped up in a nice clean ending. Discovery doesn't do that. However, the Orville kind of does, but the Orville does it in a way that's relatable to us now. And again, I go back to even something we talked about before. I think in the Orville's case, it's more lighthearted, it's more fun, it's a little more positive, and I think a lot of people really need that in their life right now. While Discovery is dark, it's got a harder edge, and I think a lot of people are just like, I get enough of that in my real world. I don't want it in my fantasy world.
Yeah, but no one really said, I mean, not to the point where we're getting it now, no one really kind of made that claim against Deep Space Nine, which is arguably the darkest of like the Star Treks that came out up until that point. You know, that was an entire 4 seasons based on war, you know, so yeah. But everyone hails it as being one of the greatest Star Trek series ever. So that's what I don't get. I mean, why is Discovery being any different?
Let me interrupt you there. The difference being you didn't have social media when DS9 came out.
Not to this degree. You're right.
You didn't have not everybody had the same soapbox to stand on. If DS9 were to come out now and DS9 was the new show instead of Discovery, I have a feeling you'd have a lot of similar reactions to DS9 that Discovery is getting now.
That's a fair point. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of like the whole point of the subspace signals is this is where, unfortunately, I think the fandom has kind of have apexed to when it comes to this or that. So thanks, guys. That was obviously a debate that can be done for a couple other shows. Maybe we'll continue this on a little bit later and see where this argument shakes out on social media. So aside from what we've talked about here on Discoville, there are a lot of fantastic shows that you also might enjoy listening to here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Kevin, real quick, take us around the horn on what is recently been going on with our network, the Fandom Podcast Network.
Okay, of course, the Fandom Podcast Network is where you can find this show, Discoville. And I did want to mention we had a fan asking to where to find us and was having trouble. And just want to clarify, to find Discoville, make sure you go to the Fandom Podcast Network, especially if you want to use the podcast catchers that will download directly from there. And then you will find our show popping up there, as well as all of these other great shows that we have, which includes Blood of Kings, our Highlander podcast that both Norm and I co-host. And we recently got back from the Highlander 25th anniversary TV show gathering convention in Los Angeles, where we got some great audio and interviews. And we did a wrap-up show talking about our experiences. And we also included some fan interviews in that episode. And coming up, we have a panel that we did together talking about social media and what that's done for the Highlander community. And also we have an episode that has some celebrity interviews from that event as well. We also have Culture Clash, our weekly fandom show that you, Kyle, and I, we both co-host, where we talk about all the weekly culture, you know, geeky news, nerdy news, including our own movie reviews, video reviews, and all the new news in, of course, the geek world. We also have the Couch Potato Theater, where it's those movies that we like to celebrate that you don't like to get off the couch for when they come on the television. Even though you might have a copy of it sitting right over there on the shelf, you sit down and watch it. And recently we did the Blade Runner retrospective, the original Blade Runner. And also we the Doomsday, one of my guilty pleasures, starring Rhona Mitra. And we have many more coming up as well. We also have Time Warp, where we celebrate 1987, the movies. Time Warp is where we like to look back on a fandom and celebrate it and talk about it. And, of course, this is the 30th anniversary of 1987, and we are going to be having one more episode coming out about the Christmas and holiday movies that came out during 87. And we also did a Buffy special on Halloween, where we talked about the 20th anniversary of Buffy the Vampire Slayer television series. And Kyle, you knocked it out of the park with Aaron Gill. Did some serious Buffy knowledge here, Kyle.
Although, let me jump in here for a second, because we had, there was some feedback from one of our listeners, both on Blood of Kings and here on Discoville, Jill Berticus, who's a friend of ours. Did she correct you guys on a piece of Buffy trivia, as I read?
What it was there was a, there was something that happened to Buffy, but it happened in the comic 8th season that Josh Whedon also wrote. So, but it was kind of a significant thing about Buffy having a experience that Willow was normally having. So, but
yeah, you know,
but does Jill really count? Because I think she's pretty much an unofficial member of the Fandom Podcast Network at this point.
Pretty much, you know.
Yeah, and you know, with even if we did miss one point, I got to tell you, you guys were on point for that special. You guys dropped heavy Buffy knowledge on there, and I was impressed. And that was a fun thing to be on. We also have Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with hosts Tom, Brandon, and Chris. If you love Alfred Hitchcock, or you are just curious and you don't know much about him, make sure you check this out as they talk about the master of suspense himself, Mr. Alfred Hitchcock. And of course, it is football season, and my co-host, Kyle, we love to talk football in the end zone. And both Kyle and I have teams in the same division. Kyle is a Chiefs fan. I'm a Raiders fan. So that always comes up for some great conversation. And we give the best mediocre fantasy football advice.
That's the best tagline ever. So we have a few minutes here, and one of the things I'd like to take a little bit of time here is to thank the fans that have been listening to Discoville since the beginning. Kyle, you've actually shared some really good numbers with me about the downloads and the participation of the fandom community that's been listening to our show and how well we've been doing. And I think that that attributes to, I think, how important these two shows are right now to fandom, right? Because this is Star Trek, and you're having kind of a spiritual Star Trek show. So I think that's something that we feel was necessary to do this show for, because we need that voice. We need a voice where we can come in and celebrate both shows. But I'm surprised. Were you surprised?
Honestly, no, because I think we here at the Fan Podcast Network, what we do with Discoville and try to keep it on an open level, even keel, and try to be positive about both shows, but not be afraid to criticize when we do, bring a fresh perspective. And I think we were very early in jumping on doing something with the Orville, and I think a lot of people were very appreciative of that as well. And I think they get a good mix of getting both shows here in Discoville, and that a lot of credit goes to you for that, Norman.
Well, it's we are all fans of this, and it's something I think that we felt very strongly about. But I think probably because of what we talked about in Subspace Signals, where why aren't there more spaces out there where fans can come together collectively and celebrate as opposed to divide themselves and not have that opportunity to talk about all these great ideas that we used to talk about before? Because there's nothing better, in my opinion, than being passionate about a show, bringing that passion to somebody else, sharing it, whether or not they agree with you, but at least having the conversation. So that's been our mission here for Discoville. And thank you so much, everybody who's joined us on our Facebook page and who's subscribed to the feed and who's been downloading, because without you, we can't make this happen. So thank you very much for supporting the show. And make sure that if you have friends who feel about it the way that we feel about it, make sure that you invite them to listen to the show and to come to our page on Facebook. Kevin, one last thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I had some encouraging words from my friend Jennifer. She really liked the show. She loves both shows. She feels that there is room enough in fandom for both of these, and she loves it. She liked to come on sometime. And I just wanted to echo your thoughts that, you know, if you know other friends of yours, please have them come on a Facebook page and give us a listen. And I really think that we have an audience here, and we really are proud of that. We want to nurture that, especially not just the numbers of our downloads, but also on the Discoville Facebook page.
Absolutely. The more fans that we have there, the more friends that we make, the more conversations that we actually get to enjoy. So I'm Norm, and on behalf of my fellow Shuttle podcasters here, Kevin and Kyle, thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Discoville. Hailing frequencies are now closed, and goodbye, everyone.